Good evening. I'm glad everybody is here tonight, everybody that is here. And we're studying the life of Christ. We're in the section of lesson number 5. And Jesus was preaching in Capernaum. If you want to go ahead and open up your Bibles to Matthew chapter 4, we're going to begin with that. Also from Luke chapter 5. And then eventually we'll go to Mark chapter 1 also. So as some of you know, I had my Bible rebound. I had them add markers. I now have 3 markers in my Bible. And on times like this, that is a wonderful thing to be able to mark 3 different places. And I'm enjoying that very much. All right, let's turn to, again, Matthew chapter 4. As we begin our study tonight, just to recap a little bit where we finished up with last week. Again, Jesus in the city of Capernaum. He spent a lot of time in there during his ministry. And it was there that we read about Andrew and Peter and how that Jesus had called them to follow him. We made the point that this was not the first time that he had called them to follow him. But we made the point that this was the first time he asked them to follow him with a job to do. There was a task at hand now that he needed them for. And again, what was that task? What was that job? To be fishers of men. I need you to go out and no longer go fishing for fish, but go fishing for men. And so he called them for that purpose. And we see him, again, not naming them as the apostles now, but in essence calling them to be part of his disciples and to engage in the work that he had for them to do. We will take a look at this phrase in just a moment, but both regarding Andrew and Peter, and then one of the other two brothers that were called at the same time, James and John, all of them fishermen, and all of them had the same reaction of immediately leaving their nets and following him. And we talked about the miraculous catch, because it wasn't just a matter of Jesus walking along and seeing them by their nets and saying, follow me. But what else did we talk about last week that actually took place at this time? There was a crowd. What did Jesus ask Peter to do?
He asked them to push
out. Okay. So he got in Peter's boat and said, can you push me out a little ways? And while he was in his boat, he did what?
He preached.
He taught. He took advantage of the amphitheater, as it were, situation and taught the people. And then after he was done teaching, he told Peter to let's go out further. And then he told Peter to drop the nets on the other side. And any good fisherman would know if you can toss them on one side, you can toss them on the other. And Peter, we talked about Peter's reaction that I appreciate so much that Peter said and replied, at your bidding, at thy bidding, at thy word. In essence, because you said so. I'll do it because you said so. I know my trade. I know what to do. And surely Peter would have understood that, again, chancing on one side or the other wouldn't matter. And how long had they fished? They had done fish all night. And they were already engaged in what process of the whole fishing experience? Leaving the nets. They were done. And so, again, he once again asked them to, let's put your net on the other side. And he did. And the result was, the quantity of fish to Peter was clearly miraculous. And we talked about kind of finishing last week, the fact that when Peter realized, this is not normal. This is a miracle. This is a sign. And Peter's reaction to Jesus was, depart from me. He fell down before Jesus and said, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man, O Lord. And again, we talked about the fact that Peter knew that Jesus was the Messiah. He'd already been instructed about that. But here he comes face to face. He sees this miracle and he becomes overwhelmed with his own sinful condition. Realizing the divinity and holiness of Jesus, realizing who he is, and he says, depart from me, for I'm a sinful man, O Lord. And so we talked again about our need to react to our own sinfulness. We need to be aware of our own sinfulness and to be aware while we have time to do something about it. So, we come then to the encounter with James and John. And if you will, turn to Mark chapter 1. And in Mark chapter 1, yes.
One other thing. In what Peter said, even though we know that Peter was, he went and in the end denied Christ three times, but we see a lot of humility in Peter by saying what he did.
Yes.
He knew he was a simple man, and he recognized deity when he saw it.
And he recognized the incompatibility.
That's right.
Of his sinful condition and the holiness of Jesus. Absolutely. It was a remarkable attribute of Peter. So in Mark chapter 1, if I can get someone to read, let's go and go back to verse 16 of Mark 1 and read through verse 20. Mark 1:16-20. Mickey?
Verse 16, and passing along by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting a net in the sea. They were fishers. Jesus said unto them, come ye after me, and I will make you become fishers of men. Straightway they left the nets and followed him. And going on a little further, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who also were in the boat mending the nets. Straightway he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and went after him.
We talked about the Gospel of Mark and the word that is unique in the Gospel of Mark, and that word is immediately. And we see here that both Peter and Andrew, both James and John, Jesus calls them to follow him, and it says of both pairs of brothers, what was their reaction? No hesitation. Immediately. I mean, they dropped what they were doing. And again, put yourself in their shoes. You're a fisherman. That's what you've been doing all your life. That's how you survive. And Jesus comes along and says, I need you to follow me. Is there any time frame regarding this call to follow him? No, it's just follow me. I'll make you fishers of men. What thoughts would be going through our head?
What about the business?
What about how am I going to survive? How do I survive? What who's going to take care of my boat? My boat needs maintenance. What about my nets? There's a lot of these questions that would pop into our head.
We also have perspective from John's account. They had already been told by John the Baptist, he's the one you need to follow.
Yes.
And they had already been convinced that he was the Messiah.
Yeah.
And evidently they had already been taught by their father Zebedee about the Messiah. And, you don't see an argument from him. Zebedee doesn't say, hey, wait where you're going.
Right.
But I like the fact that Mark's account says that left Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants. It makes it less like they abandoned their father, because he had the hired servants as well. He could continue on with his business.
True. Yeah. True, but on the other hand, by the fact that James and John had hired servants within the family, what type of lifestyle did they perhaps enjoy?
They were successful.
They were successful in what they did. Again, they were of such a status to have hired servants. And indeed, yes, they have the knowledge, and again, our dad has help. But I think all of us, in terms of what we do for a living, we're all convinced that Jesus is the Messiah. Would we be ready to walk away from perhaps we've gone through school, we've got our education, we put in our effort, we've got our degree, we've gained the experience? Again, we can see again the challenge, the temptation in terms of follow me and to do so right now. Bruce?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that part, but when it talks about they were cleaning their nets and mending their nets, that's a task and a half. Because not only are they cleaning everything out, but they have to fix the areas that are broken and all that, and then plus get it in proper order because you just can't drop the nets and they're not functioning.
I don't know anything about cleaning nets. I mean, I don't know if you've ever, quote, cleaned fishing nets before. But I can imagine, especially for the size they would use, that'd be a chore. But again, they immediately left and followed him. Now, the question is that the way all men responded to the invitation of Jesus Christ? No, so let's compare it to the reactions of others, and let's go to, and I'm sure you're anticipating, Luke chapter 14. Luke chapter 14, beginning in verse 15. If I can get somebody to read, let's go with 15 through 24. Randy?
Luke 14, 15 through 24. When one of those who were reclining at the table with him heard this, he said to him, "Blessed is everyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God." But he said to him, "A man was giving a big dinner, and he invited many. And at the dinner hour, he sent his slave to say to those who had been invited, 'Come, for everything is ready now.' But they all alike began to make excuses. The first one said to him, 'I bought a piece of land and need to go out and look at it. Please consider me excused.' Another one said, 'I bought 5 yoke of oxen and I'm going to try them out. Please consider me excused.' Another one said, 'I have married a wife and for that purpose I cannot come.' And the slave came back and reported this to his master. And the head of the household became angry and said to his slave, 'Go out at once into the streets and lanes of the city and bring in here the poor and crippled, blind and lame.' And the slave said, 'Master, what you commanded has been done, and still there is room.' And the master said to the slave, 'Go out into the highways and along the hedges, compel them to come in so that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those men who were invited shall taste of my dinner.'"
So again, we read of the invitation, and Jesus talks about three men who were invited and who did not immediately, again, follow after him, but cited the fact that, again, one had just bought a field. Again, he'd made an investment, and he said, "I need to go check on my investments." Did he tell Jesus no? He just said, "Not now. There's something else I have to do." The other one had what? Bought yoke of oxen. Likely would have been for what purpose? I'm sorry? Yeah, to farming, because that's what he did. That's his business. And how many who would be in the business of farming, having bought something like 5 yoke of oxen, would want to go check them out? He says, "I need to do that first," and did not immediately accept the invitation. And the other, the final one, married a wife. "For that reason, I cannot come." Interesting that the man who married a wife, what was the word he used for that reason? What did Jesus call him?
Excuses.
Jesus used the word excuse. It's funny how the reasons we come up with, Jesus oftentimes considers excuses. And it says for, again, there in verse 18, talks about the fact they all began to make excuses. Again, whether it be for family relationships, again, I need to go make sure everything's all right with our father Zebedee. You know, we got to make sure that we just bought some new fishing nets. Again, that we've got a new boat. We need to take care of that. None of these things we see that Peter and Andrew and James and John used in their response to Jesus. Also, we can look to Matthew and Luke, again, chapter 9, verses 57 through 62. David?
Verse 57 says, "As they were going along in the road, someone said to him, 'I will follow you wherever you go.' And Jesus said to him, 'The foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head.' And he said to another, 'Follow me.' But he said, 'Lord, permit me first to go bury my father.' But he said to him, 'Allow the dead to bury their own dead. But as for you, go and proclaim everywhere the kingdom of God.' Another also said, 'I will follow you, Lord, but first permit me to say goodbye to those at home.' But Jesus said to him, 'No one, after putting his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God.'"
All right, so again, we see those who, after Jesus says, "Follow me," said, "But first." But first there's something that comes before that. And Jesus said, once you put your hand to the plow, there's no looking back. Are you going to make the commitment to follow me or not? And again, are we going to come up with other reasons why things that we need to do first? Again, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 26 talks about, again, Moses. And it talks about Moses, the fact that he was able to overcome the passing pleasures of sin because he looked to what?
Treasures.
The treasures, the reward of God, that which is more important. And again, if we're going to, you know, be using the example of Peter and Andrew and James and John, was there had to be, again, the reason for them. They were looking to the reward. They were looking to the fact that he was the Messiah. They were looking to him because they understood that he was the King of the Jews. They understood that he was going to, again, usher in the kingdom that was now being preached as near. So, again, I appreciate the fact that as we ourselves, in terms of something we need to do to follow Christ, whether we're talking to somebody who has yet to obey the gospel, need to impress upon ourselves, upon others, the immediacy of the response that is needed from us. Or whether or not we're going to, again, like here in Luke chapter 9, say, but first. Anything else then about Peter and Andrew and James and John and their following after Jesus?
Just a note on the context of Luke chapter 14, these folks who gave what I call this fashionable world. And this, the application is made by the Lord in verse 25 of that context. We know that there were great multitudes, the verse tells us, but he turned to them and said, if any man cometh after me, he hateth not his own father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And then he proceeds to talk with them about counting the cost of discipleship.
I think three times he doesn't even not use the expression, cannot be my disciple. And I always find that fascinating that he would have such a multitude before him, such an audience, and what he chose to preach on was, who can't be my disciple? Rather than try to, as it were, keep the multitude before him. Thank you, Mick. Anything else then about Peter and Andrew and James and John? Is that a twitch of the finger, Jonathan? Okay. You got to be careful with those auctions. All right. So let's go back to Matthew chapter 4. And in Matthew chapter 4, if I can get someone to read the last three verses of that chapter, 23 through 25. Matthew 4, 23 through 25. Randy?
Jesus was going throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogue and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness among the people. The news about him spread throughout all Syria, and they brought in all who were healed, those suffering with various diseases and pains, demoniacs, epileptics, paralytics, and he healed them. Large crowds followed him from Galilee and Decapolis and Jerusalem and Judea and from beyond the Jordan.
All right, so what... We titled this, as it were, Preaching in Capernaum, but what is it exactly, according to this text, that Jesus was doing? What were his activities? Well, first of all, it says there, beginning of verse 23, he was going about where? In all of Galilee. We see later on in verse 24, he was also the news about him spread where? All Syria, in the verse 25. Great multitudes followed him from where?
Galilee, Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and from beyond the Jordan. That just about is the whole
world. Yeah. They were coming from everywhere. They were coming from everywhere. So he was going about in all Galilee, and they were coming to him. And what was he doing as he went about in all Galilee? He was teaching in their synagogues. And what was he teaching?
Proclaiming the gospel.
Okay, so he was proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. That's what he was talking about. We already, in John chapter 4, again, he was talking to the woman, the Samaritan woman, about the kingdom. He was talking to Nicodemus about about entrance into the kingdom. Here we see throughout all of Galilee, he's going about in their synagogues, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. And also, what else was he doing as he went about all of Galilee? Okay, so again, he was healing every kind of disease. And we see now, again, a general reference to an abundance of miraculous signs on behalf of Jesus, healing all kinds of disease. The result, then, of what Jesus did, beginning in verse 24 of that context, we see the impact that he had, and we've already commented really on that. First of all, the impact included the fact that news about him went out into all Syria. So again, the message is spreading. And again, it's always interesting to know that Jesus instructed any of these people to, you know, go tell other people about me. Go spread the news. Again, you know, when we talk about the Samaritan woman, nobody had to tell her, go back to the city of Sychar for a year and tell everybody about me. But she did. And again, as he is teaching in the synagogues and healing every kind of disease, again, news is spreading. People talk. And they're talking about what he is preaching. And we're going to see here real quickly in just a moment, they're talking about the fact that he is healing every kind of disease. The news about his miraculous wonder is spreading about. And so the result was that not only did the news about him spread, but part of the news included that, again, he's healing people. And so they brought to him all who were ill. And so again, if you had a mother, a brother, a dad, an uncle, who had been suffering from something, you know, for 30, 40, 50 years, and you heard Jesus of Nazareth, he's going about in Galilee and he's healing everybody who comes to him, what are you going to do? You're going to take your dad, your brother, your mother, whoever. You want them healed as well. Now, they're coming because of the healing. But we know again, as we're going to say in just a moment, what is Jesus making sure that he's doing while he's healing? He's teaching. Again, and we're going to see his commitment to that. And so again, they brought to him all who were ill. And then what else do we read there in Matthew chapter 4 about the reaction and the results of Jesus' efforts to teach the kingdom? It says that who followed him?
Large crowds.
Large crowd, great multitudes. Again, he has a large following. And again, you have to ask the question, why? Why are people following him? We don't know, but what are the two possibilities? For physical reasons or spiritual reasons. I mean, it's like authority. It's either from heaven or from God. People follow Jesus for physical reasons or spiritual reasons. Why were the multitudes following Jesus? We don't know. But again, when we get to John chapter 6, we know that Jesus knew why a lot of people followed him. In John chapter 6, a lot of people were following him, not because they saw the signs, but because he was providing the physical needs of life. And so this multitude that's following him now, are some following him just because he can take care of the physical problems? Well, no doubt there were some. Are there others who followed him because they truly wanted to know about the kingdom? I'm sure there were some also. David?
This is kind of a side note. I got thinking about when it said news went about him, went out into all Syria and all the other places in verse 25, and Mick pointed out that it was pretty much all the promised land. I can't help but think when Paul was facing Agrippa, and he said to him, you know these things happened, because they didn't happen in the corner.
Yeah.
You know these things. So
yeah.
We can see here that, yeah, he had to have heard about it.
Yeah.
And it went out this far, so he had to have known about it.
That's a good point. Again, this is not, as you said, not done in a corner. It was well publicized, not by him, but by everybody else. All right, so any other comments then about the work that Jesus did, the results that he had from Matthew chapter 4? All right, so like I said, we're going to bounce around here a little bit. Let's go to the account in Mark. That's Mark chapter 1. And we're going to pick it up we already read from verse 16 through verse 20. And let's read verse 21 through 28. Jen?
And they went to Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this, a new teaching with authority? He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee.
All right. Thank you. So we see again, he's in Capernaum. It's on the Sabbath. He enters the synagogue and begins to teach. And they were amazed at his teaching. Again, we'll read that in other contexts during the life of Christ, that the way he taught was unlike anybody else that they had ever heard. They were amazed at his teaching. And what was the characteristic of his teaching that they were amazed about? He taught with authority. Jesus taught with authority. And it's interesting, there's two different words that are sometimes translated power in the New Testament. One is the Greek word dunamis, which means just physical might, strength, power. You know, that's where we get the word dynamite. And oftentimes that's translated power. There's another word that's translated power sometimes. It's the Greek word exousia. What is that type of power? As we have on the screen. It's authority. It's the right to rule. I mean, it's what makes somebody have the right to, as a word, call rules, to call the shots. He's in charge. Why? Because he has that power. He has that authority. He has exousia. And someone explained this to me years ago, I don't remember if it was Mickey or whoever, somebody somewhere, the difference between exousia and dunamis could be explained by the sheriff in the Old West movie. That he had, the sheriff in the Old West movie had both exousia and dunamis. What was his dunamis? What was his what? He had the gun. That was his power, right? What was his exousia? What was his right to rule? He had the star on his chest. That was his authority. And you remember in the old Western movies that the old sheriff would say, "Stop in the name of the law." What law? The law based on the authority he had of that star that was on his chest. Did he have the dunamis power to back that up? Yes. But Jesus here is teaching, and they recognize his right to rule, his authority, and recognize that he taught with authority, that he had the right to rule. But what else happened then? And again, what day of the week is this? Sabbath day. So he's in the Sabbath, and what happens in the synagogue? He's teaching, and then what happens? Who comes in? Okay. And all none of us have ever, and this is kind of hard, anybody ever seen a man with an unclean spirit, a demon-possessed man? I try to imagine sometimes what a scene that must have been. Of someone with that unclean spirit coming into the synagogue. And what's this man with unclean spirit saying?
We know who you are.
Okay. What do we have to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. And again, as Jesus is trying to teach, this man comes in. Is he saying this softly? Previous verse says he's cried out. So again, he's making quite the scene, isn't he? What do we have to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? Does this unclean spirit know who he is? I know who you are. First of all, have you come to destroy us? It makes me think, did any angelic being or spirit or anybody else understand the plan of God? Did this unclean spirit understand why Jesus was there? No. Have you come to destroy us? That's not what this is all about. Have you come to destroy us? And then ends his statement with, I know who you are. Did these unclean spirits, do demons, do Satan's servants know who Jesus is?
They know he has the power to destroy them.
Okay. Good point. And they know who he is. And they know his power. I know who you are, the Holy One of God. It's interesting. When Jesus and the apostles sometimes had people, as it were, trying to help them out, is this the type of help that Jesus was looking for? No, it's not. And in fact, is it just detracting from what he's trying to accomplish? Yes, it is. And so we see again, Jesus rebuked him, saying, be quiet and come out of him. And again, this man with the unclean spirit who had been crying out in the synagogue, speaking these things about Jesus, Jesus then rebukes him, saying, be quiet and come out of him. What happens, verse 26? Throwing him into convulsions, the unclean spirit cried out with a loud voice and came out of him. Again, I can't imagine what that scene was like. But had these people in the synagogue ever seen anybody command an unclean spirit to come out of somebody and then to see it happen on the spot? And again, what do we see happen like in the book of Acts? When miracles were performed, when Ananias and Sapphira again lied and then dropped dead on the spot, what was the reaction? Great fear came upon all the church. Could you imagine the fear that came upon those in the synagogue who had been hearing him already teaching with authority? And now they see this man with the unclean spirit come in and crying out, and Jesus rebuking him and saying, come out of him. And immediately he went into convulsions and the unclean spirit came out. But you could have heard a pin drop. Again, the power that Jesus had demonstrated over the unclean spirit, had he demonstrated his right to rule, and he demonstrated his power over this unclean spirit. And so again, we see after teaching with authority, he casts out the demon. And then we read after the demon, unclean spirit, had been cast out. Verse 27. And they were all amazed. So they debated among themselves, saying, what was their question?
What's this been teaching?
What is this? A new teaching with authority? He commands even the unclean spirits and they obey him? What is this? Who is this? What did we just see? We heard him teaching with authority. We now see him command the unclean spirit to come out. What is this? What was it? It was the power of God. It was Jesus evidencing who he was. We see the reaction again. And it's interesting again, the expression, a new teaching with authority. And when we get into, again, just a little bit further in our study, when Jesus preaches the Sermon on the Mount, what did Jesus repeatedly say in the Sermon on the Mount regarding his teaching?
You
have heard it said, but I say to you. Is it a new teaching? It was a new teaching. It was Jesus, again, as we use the expression, Jesus giving his testament. This is his covenant. It's his teaching. It's his kingdom. And he's telling and he's teaching and he's preaching about his kingdom. with a teaching that they have not heard before. And again, the news spread everywhere. Mickey?
Just a point of contrast that's made here that I find quite interesting. Not as their scribes.
Right.
How would you like to have been one of those scribes in that synagogue that day when those things occurred? And then the question, I think, that follows is, how did the scribes teach them? These are learned men who made copies of the law. How did they teach them? How did that contrast what Jesus was doing? The scribes, I understand from material reading, they would quote this name, and quote this name, and quote this name. Jesus is not quoting anybody.
No.
He's just saying, here's what I have to say to them.
When it came to the authority, especially of the Pharisees, what was the authoritative doctrine of the Pharisees? Was it the written word? Now again, go back to what he said on the Sermon on the Mount. You have heard it said. It was the oral law. It was what got passed down orally from generation to generation that carried the weight. Jesus never appealed to what you've heard. Jesus never appealed, well, your father and your great-grandfather and successive generations have taught these things. You're right. He appealed to his authority, not based on what had been passed down, what the Pharisees had established through their oral law.
I don't know much about the Jewish exorcists, but I know they're mentioned in Acts chapter 19, verse 13. Verse 11 says, God was performing extraordinary miracles by the hands of Paul, so that handkerchiefs and aprons were carried from his body to the sick, and diseases left them, and his spirits went out. But also some of the Jewish exorcists who went from place to place attempted to make over those who had the evil spirits. The name of the Lord Jesus saying, I adjure you by Jesus who Paul preaches. But it says, seven sons of one Sceva, a Jewish chief priest, were doing this. And the evil spirit answered and said to them, I recognize Jesus and I know about Paul, but who are you? And the man in whom was the evil spirit leaped on them and subdued all of them and were powerless, so that they fled out of the house naked and wounded. It's even a bit comical to read that account of how that happened. But do we know anything more about Jewish exorcists? I mean,
well, first of all, I'd say from that context, an operative word there is they attempted. And again, as you pointed out, the other key words, they know about Paul. They know about those who were the Lord's apostles. They didn't know about these men. And the interesting thing, I think one of the lessons, we laugh about the fact that they fled naked, but I think it's symbolic of the fact that they were exposed for being the fraudulent, trying to name over, people in the name of Christ. They didn't have any authority. They attempted. I just think it's ironic in the words of Hebrews, they left naked and exposed. They had been shown to be frauds, both literally and figuratively. In terms of I don't know a lot about exorcism. I'll just know those men there in Acts 19 were frauds. So, again, this whole aspect of demon possession and casting out demons, we don't understand that. I don't know what that scene was like. But I know that there were those who, by the power of God, cast out the evil spirits, and then there were those who attempted to and couldn't.
I want to point out Matthew 12. Jesus is accused of casting out demons by the power of Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons.
Right.
And then this is Matthew 12:25. It says, knowing their thoughts, Jesus said that any kingdom divided against itself is laid waste, and any city or house divided against itself will not stand. If Satan casts out Satan, is he divided against? He is divided against himself. How then will his kingdom stand? If I, by Beelzebul, cast out demons, by whom do your sons cast them out? For this reason, they will be your judges. If I cast out demons by the Spirit of God, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. But he mentions if by whom do your sons cast them out. So were there Jews casting out demons? Sounds like it.
Or were there Jews attempting to cast that? I don't know.
Well, but he says, by whom do your sons cast them out? So, I don't know. I just don't know.
All right. Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it's a topic that I'll just let the scriptures say what they say. You know, I don't understand all there is about, you know, demon possession and the time when Jesus cast the legion into the herd of swine. And I mean, it's something that, again, we haven't experienced. And David?
Well, first, I think Lisa had a question, and then I have one.
I'm sorry, Lisa?
No, I was just going to say that we have to consider the fact that in Acts, those men didn't know Jesus. Sorry. They said by the Jesus that Paul preaches, they weren't trying, they were attempting to do what Paul and the apostles were doing. But Paul and the apostles knew Jesus, and they were using the power that God gave them. These men were frauds, and not only were exposed by being frauds, but even their words exposed them. They were not even knowledgeable enough to use the correct words to get the power to do what they were doing. Right. They were trying to piggyback on what somebody else is doing.
Sure.
That never works.
No.
I just kind of want to add to what Vic said about, imagine being one of those scribes in that situation. And not only Jesus talk and speak with authority, you know, and the scribes, a lot of those people look to the scribes as their spiritual leaders, but here comes the fellow with this is a new thing, but not only that, he's healing the sick and casting out demons.
Yeah.
So it's just like rubbing alcohol on a wound or something.
Never seen that before. Yeah. And you read the word that they were all amazed, and I'm it's kind of like, you know, how do you describe this? Nothing been ever seen like that before. Again, and both in the manner of teaching and the miracles. All right, so continuing on in Mark chapter 1, let's read verses 29 through 34. Mark 1, 29 through 34, Bruce.
And forthwith they went out of the synagogue, the inmates of the house of Simon and of Andrew and James and John, and Simon's wife, mother lay sick of the fever. And told it, and came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and the demon left her, and she ministered unto them. And even the son did say, and they brought him unto all that were diseased, and them that were possessed with demons, and all the city were gathered together. And he healed many that were cadavers and diseases, and carried out many devils, and suffered not the devils to speak, because they knew him. And in the morning.
All right, that's good. So verse 29, again, there's that word that Mark uses immediately. So he casts out the demons in the synagogue, they're all amazed, he leaves there. Evidently, who invites him over? Peter and Andrew. And so it says immediately after they had come out of the synagogue, they came into the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. So they're in Andrew and Peter's house. And who else is there according to verse 30? Okay, so Simon's mother-in-law was lying sick with a fever. First of all, so what else in terms of Peter being the one who follows after Jesus, we know what about him at this point already? He's married. He's got a wife. He has a mother-in-law. But Jesus has called him to follow after him. And Peter's mother-in-law is sick with a fever. We don't know what's causing that. Again, we know that there are a lot of reasons for a fever. There are a lot of fevers that we might not be too concerned about today because we go to the doctor, we get some antibiotics, and we deal with it. At that time, a fever could be more serious. And she was sick with a fever. And it says, immediately they spoke to Jesus about her. Okay, so they described her condition to Jesus, and he came to her, raised her up, taking her by the hand, and the fever left her. Did he say anything? He just raised her up by the hand. And again, anybody who's had children with fever, grandchildren, do fevers leave like that? It takes time.
Plus, usually after you've had a fever, you kind of lay around for a while because you don't feel good immediately. But she got up and waited on
it. Exactly. So the fever left her, and she immediately, again, she went from fever to no fever. And again, yeah, anybody who's had 103, 104 fever, you have the flu, something like that, you get rid of the fever, you feel like a truck ran over you.
Yeah.
I mean, you ache and you hurt and you're tired and you can't do anything. But again, to show the miracle, again, the fever left her immediately. And again, she raised up and she, again, waited on them. Verse 32, and when evening had come after the sun had set, they began bringing to him all who were ill and those who were demon-possessed. Again, in the synagogue, he had cast out a demon. Again, Peter's mother-in-law had been healed of the fever and immediately, again, was serving them. Word gets out. Who now is at the door of Peter and Andrew's house? I don't know exactly what type of scenario that was. Could you imagine the whole city, even if you lived in a town of a few hundred or a few thousand, being at your door? And Jesus proceeds to do what?
Teach.
But yes, he healed many who were ill with various diseases, cast out many demons. He did not permit the demons to speak because they knew who he was. So, no doubt he was trying to teach, but the whole town was there for what purpose?
To get healed.
We can get cured from anything. And he's got the whole town at his door. At Peter and Andrew's door. And this goes on, evidently, into the evening. And verse 35, and we'll pick it up here next week. And in the early morning, while it was still dark, he arose and went out and departed to a lonely place and was praying there. That's a powerful verse. Again, we're going to get to the point, verse 38, Jesus came to teach. How much teaching is going on right now? David?
You know, reading this, wouldn't you think that these so-called today's faith healers or supposed dealers, that if they could really do what they say they do, that the large crowds would be standing at the door waiting to get in? You would hear about it, wouldn't you?
Well, that's a good point. Again, true miracles created quite an effect, didn't it? Again, huge multitudes followed him. An entire city gathered at the door because they heard about this. And he healed and cured these people. And again, it went on into evening time. It came time to go to bed. And I don't know how much sleep he got, but Jesus knew he needed something. What did Jesus need? He needed time with his Father in heaven. He needed time to go and pray to his Father. And what did it take for him to have that time? He's got to get up early. He got to go find a quiet place. We'll talk more about that next week. Thank you.